extended period. And she's agreed to talk about the history of title.
Some of the history,
and
yeah.
And the maths associated with it.
The maths, he knows that that's how we say it in Australia, with the plural. Yeah, I guess maybe you asked me to do, I don't know why you asked me to talk about this, but Doug and I published a paper in 2002 where we just casually put together the Q values with using Q with Hutt's, actually it's Eggleton's formulation of tides, because we wanted to be able to have arbitrary eccentricities and inclinations, which is what Eggleton actually added to Hutt in a very beautiful way.
Alexander had a peak.
Look, Alexander's there. There's a whole lot of people. I know, isn't it? Yeah, I know. I was looking at this. Just ridiculous. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So, but all I'm really only going to mention Darwin. And Jeffries and Goldreich relied on this paper by Jeffries, and there are a whole lot of other papers I'm not going to talk about. What I really want to try and get to is to try and show you flesh out the idea of this concept of constant lag angle versus constant lag time. And this is, it seems to be the fundamental difference between using Goldreich's formulation and using all the other, well, the other formulations, which effectively rely on Darwin's idea of a lag time. And so we can talk about the physical differences between them. That's where I want to get. Yes, there is quite a bit of celestial mechanics in here, but I also wanted to, I'm hoping to, without looking at all the details, hope to show you that there are simpler ways of, you use beautiful spherical harmonics in the, like Gordon was showing before, to put all this together. Anyway, so the famous paper that people in planetary science rely on is Goldreich and Sota, Q in the solar system. Of course, there are others, but this gives us the first order in eccentricity, the rate of change of the eccentricity, and the semi-major axis. And it comes after an earlier paper by Goldreich where he introduced the idea of using Q and all these lag angles. And then there's Hutt in 1981, and yes, Alexander and others, but I guess Hutt's sort of the one that people sort of think about. And he was particularly thinking about binary stars. So that's another aspect of this. There's the binary star community over there with their ipsilateral motion constant and so on. And over here there's the planet guys, and historically they evolved separately, and now they're, I guess they talk to each other occasionally. So both the Darwin model and the all its offshoots are the equilibrium tide model, which Gordon mentioned before. And it's based on the concept of having hydrostatic equilibrium. And in particular, what that assumption allows you to do is to, if you can work out the tidal potential due to a disturbing body, then you assume, this equilibrium tide model assumes, that the shape the distorted object assumes is the same shape as the tidal potential. In other words, surfaces of constant density coincide with surfaces of constant potential. And I think Dong mentioned before, if you have a barytrope, you can write, you know, pressure is by definition, pressure is just a function of density, and it directly follows that these two surfaces of constant potential and density line up. So, whoops, no, don't push that one. Push. So, people who weren't here before, these are my scanned pencil written notes, and when I projected them, they didn't, you couldn't read them. So I had a lot of help here before making this readable, and it's actually on iPhoto, of all things. This one's not so good. And so if the, well, have I got there? The end state of tidal evolution, of course, a synchronous rotation of both bodies, spins aligned with the orbit normal and, of course, a circular orbit. In that case, you really do have hydrostatic equilibrium, and each particle in the distorted bodies, well, is not moving relative to its neighbour, and so there's no dissipation. But we use this equilibrium tide model when these things aren't true, at least, well, for when we're near this state, of course, using the Hutt model, which is applies to all eccentricities, that's, you know, you can really question that. But anyway, if you're not in this state, each particle will feel a time-varying potential, and formally a dynamical tide is excited, even if the amplitude is very small. And as a mathematician, I like to draw this analogy with a forced oscillator. When I'm trying to tell my students about this, you have a homogeneous solution and a particular solution, and the dynamical tide is the natural response of the forced object, and if you like, the equilibrium tide corresponds to. That's one way to think about it. So the forcing.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Yeah. Okay. You know, when I write this down, I thought Gordon's going to say, "Excuse me, Rosemary, I don't think I agree with that analogy." Yes.
But isn't it? Well, I mean, your C1 and C2 are going to depend on the initial conditions, which a dissipative system would be forgotten.
But you've got to keep forcing it.
It seems to me the analogy of the equilibrium tide is the response of the oscillator in the limit of low frequency. Which gives a certain amplitude.
Okay, I guess I'm thinking from the point of view that it assumes the shape of the forcing in some sense. Anyway, if I could, I'll cross that out for you, good, but I'll never say it ever again. Okay. Oh, no, I've done it again. I'll learn. My brain will get programmed to not do that, to use that. Okay, so... So you don't have to read all the details. I'll try and just sort of talk it through. So I want to set the problem up in the nice, quaint kind of way that Darwin did, and I'm going to read this quote to you because it's so beautiful. That's the only quote I'll make. There is Darwin at Jeffries in 19... I've forgotten something. 61. I think his idea was to condense Darwin and to sort of clarify some things. Well, I think he did the opposite in some ways. It's a horrible paper, in my opinion. It's an example of the reason lots of people were put off by physics, because it's really hard to follow. There are things not defined and so on. So, you know, I've suffered. however, and whenever I have tried to read this paper, I imagine Peter Goldreich doing the same thing and just getting it. He'd just get it. Yeah, I know what he means. Yeah, all those bits left out, he would just get it because, you know, he's Peter Godlike and whatever. Peter writes much more beautifully. Peter really does write nicely.
Jeffries, I think,
used
to publish everything you wrote down.
Well, there are lots of things that were missing, so it can't be true. I don't know. Having said that, Darwin was a beautiful writer, and of course he was nutting this stuff out, you know, from first principles. I think there were some things before him, but his paper was 179 pages long. So, and, you know, we can laugh, but if you didn't know anything about this, you might take that many pages. And also he likes to say everything in detail. So as a student of the subject, it helps a lot. So let's imagine, so he starts, you know, imagine we have, and I'm going to use the Earth and the Moon as my two objects. The Earth is the distorted object. I'm going to later introduce a thing called, a little particle called Diana, which is a name that Darwin introduced. I don't know why. Was one of his kids called Diana? I thought, is one of the moons in the solar system called Diana? I don't know why it's called Diana. maybe. I don't know. Anyway, Diane is not in the story yet. We've just got the Earth and the Moon and no viscosity, so the tidal bulge will line up with the Moon, of course. And each fluid particle will rise and fall with a frequency just for this, you know, simple one in a circular orbit, they'll just be this frequency. And so, of course, for synchronous rotation, each particle will be stationary in the frame of the rotating body. So, okay, so that's no viscosity. So Darwin goes on to say, now suppose that at any instant the fluid becomes endowed with friction. Then those particles of fluid which happened at that instant to be in the equatorial, R-E-A-L at the end, protuberances, cannot fall so quickly as they did before the friction began to act. Thus the particles linger in the protuberances longer, so gorgeous, than they should do, and the particles which ought to be rising do not rise so quickly as they should. The obvious consequence of this is that the equatorial protuberances and depressions are carried on along with the planet's rotation, and the longer axis of the equator now points in advance of the satellite in its orbit. So this assumes that the Earth, as is actually the case, is spinning faster than the Moon orbits. This condition is perpetuated as long as the friction lasts. Tides of this kind are said to lag. Well, we might say that one leads. A leading lag, and the angle of lagging may be defined as the angle between the longer axis of the equator and the direction of the satellite. So there we introduce the idea of a tidal lag, but that's for a circular orbit. The bulge will have this lag, and there will just be one lag angle. Press the right button. Oops, hang on. Not too far. Okay, so there's the lag angle leading the line of centres when the spin frequency is greater than the mean motion. So for eccentric orbits, there are additional tidal components, of course, and each of these will have their own lag angle. So the way this is set up, and this is, well, Darwin, I mean, let's just jump to Jeffries, almost unintelligible for little old me anyway, but how it works is, you first of all, you write down the potential of the perturber, so the Moon, the potential at every point in space due to the Moon. Then you ask how the distorted body responds, what shape it assumes. You can work that out, and each particle will respond to the potential it finds itself in. So that's the body itself, the actual bulge and the perturber. And then you can, and this is what we want to get to, calculate the back effect on the orbit. How does the orbit respond to, how does the orbit of the Moon respond to this distorted, the body that it has distorted? I've done it again. So, sorry. So, I won't go through all these details. Gordon showed us the lovely Legendre expansion of the potential. But so we put the origin at the centre of the Earth, and we don't draw the Earth in yet. We're just looking at the potential of this guy. Of course, it would just be 1 on R if we put the origin here, but we put it here, and we get this expression, and we can expand it in Legendre polynomials. And we have a monopole, a dipole, and a quadrupole term, and so on and so on. And, you know, you might think, why is there a dipole term? This is the potential, but actually what we're interested in ultimately is the forces. And if you take the gradient of this potential with respect to R, R is the thing we're asking for, how the potential varies with R, then we find, well, this is a constant as far as little r is concerned. This dipole potential term here just gives the force, the point mass, two-body acceleration, and then the tidal acceleration comes from the gradient of this P2, and that's the distorting potential that we're interested in. So we focus on the fact that this is, so we're truncating it at quadrupole, and in particular this gives is the shape that the distorted body is going to assume, because this is how the potential varies from point to point in space. Now, I know I'm preaching to lots of converted people here, but who well know this stuff, but maybe there are some people who don't know it so well. So step two, we want to work out the tidal distortion, and this is sort of involved, and I'm not going to show the details except to say that you can work out, and we're not concerned about viscosity at this point, just the shape. I said before that we want to work out how each earth element feels. Each earth element will feel the potential due to the main part of the body, the bulge itself, and the companion, and one can work out the shape in this hydrostatic equilibrium approximation. We know the shape must be the same as the tidal potential, so we can figure that out. And of course, that tidal potential may be time varying, but that's a neat thing. Just the only thing I'll state here is that the height of the tide is proportional to, now here we see the love number for the first time, plus one, and of course it depends on the ratio of the mass of the perturber to the thing being distorted, and the size of the distorted object compared to the distance of the perturber. And we notice that even if the thing, the perturbed object, is completely centrally condensed, it will still be distorted, and so we see that this is not zero. On the other hand, if it's completely centrally condensed, the perturber will not feel any extra potential other than the point mass potential. So,
there seem to be three different constants that describe oblateness. There seems to be the love numbers, the J constants, and the absolute constant. So is the absolute constant okay, just twice the first?
That's just historical, but it's also, I guess, I mean, Stan could say more about this, but my impression is that the love number, people were thinking about rigid body or solid bodies when they were defining the love number. Is that right, Stan?
That's my.
That's historically sort of the way it came. Now we use it for the gaseous planets, but historically I think that, although, I mean, Peter Goldreich was, he talked about the gaseous planets too, although he really concentrated on this idea of rigidity. But the Epsilon motion constant is something the binary star people were thinking of, and for some reason they just defined it without, you know, as half, just. So, but the setup is kind of similar. So we want to know how the perturber reacts to, or how the orbit evolves, basically, due to this tidal bulge. So we know, what do I want to say there? No dissipation. Well, tidal bulge. Oh, yeah, okay. So if there's no dissipation, the only effect is that the orbit will, there'll be epsilon advance. It's not precession, people. Precession is rotation of the plane of the orbit about some direction. So an epsilon motion is rotation in the plane of the orbit, rotation of the orbit. And of course, we also get this from spin oblateness. So you'll get that just from the non-sphericity of the planet. But with dissipation, of course, the tidal bulge lags or leads, and there are tidal torques, and energy loss. Energy is taken out of the orbit. Potential. Okay. So the next step is to again argue, well, the potential, so we want to know how the perturber moves due to this tidal bulge, the tidal potential. We know that the bulge's potential is proportional to the tidal potential, and so there I write it down here. Here's a constant of proportionality, and here is the tidal potential. So what is that constant of proportionality? One can show that it is this quantity here. So here is the Love number, tidal Love number. And so if that is, so if you have a completely centrally condensed object, this is zero and this is zero. So the bulge, there's no potential associated with it. And again, of course, we have this the usual ratio of the mass of the perturber to the distorted body, and the size of the perturbed, the distorted body to the distance cubed. Okay, now Diana, here's little Diana here, is introduced. Now this is a little tricky thing that, I mean, in hindsight is maybe obvious, but it's a mistake that I've made, Peter Eggleton's made, and maybe lots of other people have made, not having a Diana in the picture. You're just asking, well, how does the orbit evolve given this tidal bulge, this lagged tidal bulge? And you get things wrong because it's sort of like it's self-referential in some sense. You need to say, here is a tidal bulge. It's there because it's just there, or you know, you could have a permanent quadrupole moment or whatever. But here is a distorted shape, and here is a test particle. Could be anywhere. Doesn't have to be sitting here. How does it respond to this bulge? So we write down. We can write down the. what do we write down? Well, what we do, and I'm not going to go through all the details, but I do want to point out one thing. What we can do is expand this thing with this proportionality constant. So there's a big R there, that's the moon's distance, and this is little r, this is Diana's distance. I'm going to expand this thing. I use spherical harmonics because they really make it a lot easier, and Gordon already showed some of that before. And so ultimately we want, this is the disturbing function basically, and from that we can use Lagrange's planetary equations to ask how the elements evolve. So just quickly, so we use the addition theorem gives us these Legendre functions in terms of spherical harmonics, which, you know, as some people run them off, they see these, but actually they're really powerful, useful things. And in particular, if you work in the plane, then the complicated, these associated Legendre functions in here, which sort of make it more complicated. But if you're just talking about motion in the plane, and you just get these azimuth angles coming into it, and it simplifies it considerably. And in particular, P2 is just has these three components. In fact, these two are just the complex conjugate of each other. So, and I find just working with these exponential, rather than trig the causes and signs, makes it really easy to gather together all your complicated angles and frequencies and things. So we need to write these azimuth angles in terms of the orbital elements, basically. And we need to, and this is, I'm going through this just to show how the tidal lag angles are introduced. So if we, well, here it is again, that's the whole disturbing function. This phi of Diana minus phi of bulge, that's the angle that we're interested in. Phi of Diana, so phi is just a spherical polar phi, and we can write it in terms of the true anomaly and the longitude of periastron, and we can write r in the usual, you know, Kepler way, and we can and because these things are periodic, we know the frequency is just the mean motion, we can expand it in Fourier series. And this makes it, I think, anyway, especially if you've got Mathematica, makes it really easy to know what these terms are. And if you look at some of these older papers, they're really laboured and, you dinner. Or even Murray and Dermot, you know, they've got these long tables in the back and you look up all these different terms. And, well, I just prefer to think in terms of L's and M's and whatever. It sort of makes it easier. And so one can just write down to first order in eccentricity, because this is different to Hubble. This is what's done was done. The first few terms of this quadrant, this L equals M equals 2 term. This one's just the complex conjugate. And also the M equals 0 term that doesn't have this phase here. And you can just write these terms down. So I said I'll put this on the wiki if anyone wants to look at the details. Now here we come with the tidal lag angle. So the bulge, so we've got, just to remind you, so there's the Earth, here's the Moon sitting up. And we put the Moon at it's the Earth. Align the Moon's apsidal line with the x-axis. Here's Diana over here, and the tidal bulge is here. So this is, you know, the angle between the two things that we're interested in. So the point is, this is why I drew this. The point is that Diana's orbit is like that. It's rotated through its longitude of periastron, and the What I'm trying to get at is the bulge tracks the Moon, but is advanced by an angle, a lag angle. So the phi of the bulge is the true anomaly of the Moon plus the lag angle. That's what I was trying to say there. And big R is the orbit of the Moon. So we can do the same Fourier stuff, but we have these lag angles for each of the components, and there's one for each of these things. And I've labelled them, although it's almost impossible to read, I've labelled them in terms of these spherical harmonic numbers L and M and the Fourier number. So we can put all that, you know, all the details there, but you put it all together and you stir it around, and this, the details of this aren't for anyone to look at in especially, except to say that this is what you see in these papers with all these different terms, and it's, you know, pretty off-putting, and you think this is why celestial mechanics people are, you know, are branded as boring people, because they just look at these things all day. But the point is, if we do all this, and we've still got Diana in there, this is our disturbing function, and I've actually identified what Jeffries and Goldreich have these specific lag angles in there, so I've labelled them there. You take this thing and you can take Lagrange's planetary equations and work out the rates of change of things. So we're almost where we want to go to discuss these lag angles and so on. So, you know, here's the rate of change of the eccentricity of Diana. After we've worked this out, then we can admit to ourselves that actually Diana is really the Moon. But if you don't do it after this step, you get it wrong. And so you identify the mean motion of Diana with the mean motion of the Moon and the eccentricity and so on and so on. And the last step you do is average over the short period terms, and you get zimzelabim, you get this thing. And this is from Goldreich, 1963, didn't write it in terms of K2, but he's got the expression in terms of rigidity and blah blah blah, but this is how it comes out. Okay, here are the lag angles associated with each of these various components of the tide. So far there's no divergence. We've got Darwin, Jeffries followed, he did this, that's okay, Goldreich takes over, and we're there. Now, what do we do with these lag angles? We don't know, you know, this is where the hidden physics is.
And at this point, the only approximation you made is just averaging over the short period of term.
That's right, and truncating after the quadrupole term. So, now that thing, just for future reference, that combination of lag angles there, I've called beta. We'll come back to looking at that. Okay, now, Darwin. Let's start with Darwin and anybody else who used Darwin, like Hutt. Except Hutt started afresh and did this beautiful other analysis. But anyway, Darwin argues that the lag angle should be proportional to their speeds. So for a particular tidal component, the speed, well, of course, the object is spinning, you'll get, for example, this lag angle is proportional to 2 times the spin frequency minus 2 times the mean motion. So, of course, if you have synchronous rotation, this is zero, and there's no friction between neighbouring particles, and so on. This lag angle is proportional to this combination of the spin frequency and the mean motion, and so on. So there they are. And by the way, this is in tiny writing here, this one is associated with the semi-diurnal tide. This guy is the monthly, associated with the monthly tide, and well, there's also a diurnal tide, but I think I'm right in saying that only comes into the theory if you have non-zero obliquity. So Darwin argued that all the tide components ought to lag by the same time. So he's saying, here are the lag angles, they're proportional to these frequencies, and he takes the constant of proportionality, the lag time, to be the same for all of them. So the bulge, the tidal bulge, keeps its shape and keeps this P2 shape as the thing rotates. And I mean that's connected with the idea of that's connected with the idea of just the usual idea. I think I'm right in saying, you know, friction between in a fluid you formulate the shear by talking about neighbouring blobs of fluid and the shear that they experience rubbing up against each other. I think that's the idea that Darwin had there. And just to quote this familiar result, if you put the lag times all equal to each other, that beta, that combination of lag angles, comes out to be this quantity, and it just says that that's the wrong way around. That's the wrong way around, I think. But anyway, I think it should be E dot less is negative if the mean motion frequency is greater than this, whichever way around it goes. Anyway, so that's the familiar Darwin result. So that's a precise ordering of N and omega from this. Now, Goldreich has a different argument, which is quite compelling, actually. But this kind of is too, and I don't know which one is more reasonable. He defines Q, and you probably, anyone who's looked at this is familiar with how this is done, but you know, you want to talk about how many oscillations of the thing you're interested in, the spring or whatever, you need to have to damp one on E of the peak energy. So you can work through, you know, the work done by the fluid, by the potential the thing moves in on the fluid and so on and so on. You can work through all this, and it's very simple because the potential is time varying. You know what the frequency is of each component. And, well, you go through that and you don't need to see those details now, but in the end, out pops a Q value for each tidal component. And so for these three lag angles, this is 2 epsilon And so here's the familiar one on Q. If the lag angles are small, you can make this approximation. Now, Goldreich argues, this is his key argument, that Q, so he's appealing to lab experiments that had been done by then, that Q varies by no more than a factor of 4 over this very large frequency range, one cycle per second to one cycle per year. So he uses this to justify putting all these lag angles equal to each other. The Q values of each of these things should be the same, he argues. And if you do that, just put all that beta thing, that combination of lag angles, if you put them all equal to each other, turn the handle out, pops this number familiar to people who've used these formulas. He defines a Q prime, but it's related to the Love number and this Q in this way. And then you ask, well, does the eccentricity increase or decrease? What's the sign of this thing? Well, his argument is that it's given by the sign of this thing, 2 spin frequency minus 3 mean motion, and his argument for choosing that is simply that that's the largest, that has the biggest amplitude, that's the main contributor to E dot. So he picks that one out as the one that decides which one works. Now you notice actually that's quite close to, it's almost the same as, where's it gone, the Darwin result up here. So, you know, it's reasonable. So that's that. Now, here's something that I wish I could have thrown at a referee a couple of years ago. He could have whinged about something I'd written. But for tides raised by the moon, on the moon by the planet, we have synchronous rotation. So this is the other case that Goldreich considered. And he argued, well, here's these three lag angles, and we can, the first one's proportional. This guy, if you're synchronously rotating, this is zero, this combination. So that's zero. This one, if omega equals n, we have it's proportional to minus n, and this one is proportional to n. Now, this is what he does next. Goldreich then puts, he says, therefore, epsilon 1 equals minus epsilon 2. What is he doing when he does that? He's assuming the lag times are the same. Isn't he, Stan? Yes, he is. This epsilon 3, I've missed something. It seems to me it's proportional to n. I don't know why that doesn't get included. But anyway, and whenever I see this number 63 on 4, I think of Doug for some reason. Why would that be, Doug? 63 on 4 is the Goldreich magic number that comes here. And if you, he has one on Q prime here, if you replace it by just KT on Q, you get the other number that you see around the place, 21 on 2. So these hot Jupiters that we assume to be synchronously rotating, this is the formula that we use. That's missing an E. This should say 1 on E here. This is what we use for the evolution of the eccentricity for small eccentricity. Now, some people just use this formula for any old eccentricity. And I get upset about that if the paper's sent to me to referee. And then the retort from the authors is, well, no one knows what really happens, you know, for higher eccentricity. You know, and who knows if Hutt is right, so I'll just use this anyway, even if eccentricity is 0.9. You know, I'm thinking of a particular paper where they evolve the systems backwards in time and argue that whatever. I don't know. What? Seminal paper.
I was just kidding.
Yeah, right.
Just wanted to provoke a reaction out of you.
The seminal paper, yeah. Right. I don't think I could have that. Yeah, well. Okay. Hutt briefly, what time have we got, quarter past? Hutt, just briefly, how he does it is he replaces the tidal boulders by two little peanuts whose masses are given by, well, by this thing. half each, half of this. So you saw this before. Well, we saw a mass ratio. We saw the height of the tide as the constant of proportionality when we talked about the tidal, the potential that the Perturba moves in. So, and then this clever trick that Pete does is just, this is time varying. Of course, the mass in the bulge is going up and down, so that the mass in the bulge is time varying. And here he puts this little lag time right in here and expands it, assumes this is small, and then he works out the force, the tidal force, whatever I've said there. Anyway, and he uses energy and angular momentum arguments to derive his rates of change of the elements. It's very beautiful, as everybody knows who's studied this paper. He defines a tidal damping timescale in terms of, naturally, the lag time. It's inversely proportional to the lag time. And he just has a scaling here of the dynamical time of the tidally distorted planet. And so one can just straightforwardly relate these two things. And of course, Hutt has, his equations have the size of the body to the separation to the power of 8, and Goldreich has the power of 5, and that is confusing for people, but really it's just that it's hidden in here. So this is straightforward, and that's what we did in our paper. I'll take the blame, and so that we could have any eccentricities that we liked and still use this idea of a Q value. It's just defined, if you like, through this. And actually, one thing that may be a waste of time, I don't know. One could take the Hutt analysis and apply the, and have a different lag angle for each tidal component, and sort of, at least in the linear approximation, generalize Goldreich for arbitrary eccentricity a la Hutt, but a la Goldreich with constant lag angles. But you know, we saw today from Gordon's talk, I mean, there's so little really that's known about these Q values and the various components and the time and the frequency dependence and time dependence via the elements and so on. It's probably a waste of time to do that. But anyway, the main thing to take from this is the idea of the two physical ideas behind, or the reason one would argue for constant lag angles versus the reason one would argue for constant lag time. So the constant lag time is associated with shear. The standard idea of shear in a fluid between neighbouring particles, and the constant lag angles associated with the fact that Q, at least in the experiments that Goldreich referred to, varied very little over a great range of frequencies. So they're the two physical ideas that I have nothing to add to, but you know, you can think about them if you want to choose between the, you know, the different ways of setting it up.
Both approaches are wrong. That's what we heard this morning as well. So, but
we want to do something, and we
set the story right.
I just wanted to tell the story. This is the history of it, and so that you know what you're dealing with and where these ideas came from.
These are ansatz, they make assumptions.
That's right. So there they are, the two sets of assumptions. Well, they want to get on with the job.
Yeah.
And so if you always say, you know, make it clear we don't really know.
Perhaps a little bit more of the more recent approaches, like what Gordon described, and also what Pavlovitz and Ivanov described, is that they separate this thing into two parts. One is the excitation of an energy transfer into waves, The other part is the dissipation of the waves. Okay. And so in these description, the linear calculation is that you have a rate of momentum transfer, but it does not mean that you will lead to permanent circularization, synchronization until the waves are dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there, we don't know whether it's going to lead to constant lag time or lag angle. That's where this, these rays, the convergence of the rays, and where you get in a limit, hopefully it's like turbulence in the limit of very small viscosity, and things will converge. And in that sense, so if you don't dissipate, you can still transfer energy and angular momentum.
That it's not permanent.
That's right. Well, that reminds me of three body systems and chaos. Yeah.
I'm opening up for you.
Thank you very much, Dave. Well, I think Goldreich really did have these solid bodies in mind when he was talking about, you know, constant lag angle over this range of frequencies in solids in people's laboratories, jiggling them around. I mean, he, you know, did talk, say, oh yes, and then there's the, you know, Jupiter and whatever, but he did, but, you know, that's what he had in mind, I think, when he said it's reasonable to take all these lag angles to be the same. So, you know, we're talking about fluid bodies mostly. Of course, we're going to really have to start talking about, you know, these little guys as well with their you know, the super Earths and so on, and the Neptunes, the icy guys. But
he did go up to talk about with Goldreich and Keeley and all of that, fluids.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And that's where he was looking at the dissipation of, you know, of these disturbance in the context of, if you just use molecular viscosity, and that's, you know, enormous, huge, nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you use, this is the whole point about looking at these models of turbulence.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then later on, even also in the context of binary stars, looking at the radiative damping.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of those, you
managed to go a long way without talking explicitly about the mechanisms of dissipation.
No, that's the, no, the, okay. I mean, yeah, right. And this part is no.
So they got a long way, but recently people are talking about the real mechanisms of dissipation.
But recently we do want to go back at least 20 or 30 years, right? In binary stars, people do talk about this business of circularization period and looking at, for the convective region, looking at dissipation due to the turbulence there. In the radiative region is due to excitation of G-modes and then radiative damping associated.
Okay.
So those are direct attempt to look at this.
It's just that this, we're talking about this formalism that it persists to this day.
It does. So the constant lag angle thing, really you can associate with solid bodies. I think that's what it looks like to me anyway, yeah. And that's not what we're normally talking about. So, and as I said, this constant lag time thing's associated with shear in a fluid. I mean, it seems kind of more reasonable to use that.
And this business of exciting waves and dissipated waves, in fact, the first person who, I'm not even sure whether it's the first person, but one of the first people to raise it, at least qualitatively, was Tommy Gold.
Oh, yeah.
And Tommy Gold raised this issue about whether the dissipation, in the case of the lunar tide on Earth, whether it has anything to do with the friction at the shallow sea. And it's more to do with excitation of a wave, and then the wave gets dissipated. And that goes back to the 50s.
But the dissipation in the shallow sea is important.
No, not in Tommy Gold's
idea. No, but in fact.
No, in Jeffrey's idea. Well, you don't know in fact. Look, the moon, the same side of the moon is facing the Earth. Synchronization obviously happened, and there is no ocean.
No, I'm talking about on the Earth.
We don't know. I mean, we know that it does play a role. Who is going to be the judge? I know this is an argument.
But it's unlikely that the flow through narrow channels like the British, you know, the English Channel, don't have anything to do with the...
Who says that there's nothing to do, but it's a dominant effect?
No, that's a 10% effect, but there may be many of those. I wasn't saying that that type of effect is the dominant effect, but it has to be a significant contribution.
A Go suggestion is that the dominant effect is the wave dissipation of the waves. Okay? And then there's, of course, Jeffrey's argument is a shallow sea in the Irish Sea. Okay,
those are specific. I'd just be surprised if shallow seas didn't contribute to the...
Oh, no, I didn't say that.
That's
I said the dominance.
Oh, so I win already.
you know, you're a slippery character.
It's real fine.
Talk's being taped.
That's a key word.
Rewind.
I have a question about Eggleton. He says that you have shear and the eddies cause dissipation, but you can still go along with the equilibrium tide approach. But Gordon this morning said that in convection zones, you have to abandon equilibrium tide.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon, do you have anything to... What are we supposed to do for giant planets that have convective fluid envelopes?
I think this was first pointed out in two papers in 1998. It was the Goodman and Dixon and the Terkan et al. Dog is awful. Pointed out that you don't recover the standard equilibrium tide in a convective zone, even in a limit of very low frequency. Get something of the same order of magnitude, but it's different in detail. I might also just point out that the Darwin model with the constant lag time, I think, is natural if you have if the dissipation mechanism is a constant viscosity of your fluid, as I think you were referring to.
Well, the lag time.
Viscosity is itself a function of frequency that we were seeing this morning, then that would suggest... Yeah. Well, in fact, the particular frequency reduction that I was showing this morning would correspond more to a constant Q at high frequency rather than constant lag time. So either, in fact, it's... Or neither.
So what's your opinion about us going around using this hut kind of model anyway for high eccentricities, you know, with no dynamical tide in there and so on?
I've even written a paper myself using it, so...
I'm allowed to do one.
I was still all the letters I ever wrote.
it's probably the only thing we have that goes to high
eccentricities. Yes, I have pointed
it's
this out.
Analytical point of view, certainly one has to be aware of its limitations.
No, but there is the tableau is going to give up. That gives you at least the energy transfer.
Oh yeah, but I'm talking about the Hood formalism provides a general formalism for dealing with any kind of or as generalized by Eggleton.
Hmm.
You can deal with any kind of orbit and spin configuration, and that's very convenient for exploring the dynamics.
Hmm.
And I think I have to accept that this it's going to be difficult to connect the orbital dynamics to the fluid dynamics, and that probably this kind of parameterization will be
useful for a long time to come.
In the parabolic case, probably the better approach is to press Tukosky and
that type of
argument, right? So it's only for the eccentricity of point 1 to 0.9, maybe that is not quite appropriate.
You still have to come in really close to excite the natural modes of vibration of the
both
thing, don't
the
you?
F modes and the
R
modes.
To get that dynamical tide doing stuff.
One thing that's useful for me in America is in the case where you have a constant time lag, is you can develop it completely analytically in Cartesian coordinates, and it's very convenient then. I wrote a recent review of the origin of the satellite that comes out in something called geophysical,
some random journal.
It's publishing, and it's a treatise on geophysics. That's what the whole thing is, and ours is volume 10, where I developed the tidal theory based on that constant time lag in the appendix. Very easy to use. And you don't have to transfer back and forth between Cartesian coordinates
and one can feel more comfortable about its use in that context for solid bodies.
Only solid bodies, yes. Never picked it.
We use it for other things. I did use it when I was treating a liquid problem for gaseous planets and gaseous solar planets. But that's sort of phony when you use it's not really.
It's phony for the constant lag time is phony for fluid bodies. What?
If a star only had F mode, yeah. And it only had equilibrium tide, then there's no ambiguity in terms of how you parametrize this.
Correct.
You naturally get the constant lag time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no ambiguity there.
It's exponentially rises from viscosity, and the constant lag time corresponds to a Q that's inversely proportional to frequency.
Mm.
And that's what this delta T, constant delta T will give you. But I think it's fluid bodies or can worms that we saw this morning. The very complex frequency dependence because of resonances with the natural modes of oscillation of all these fluid bodies. And I was hoping we'd have definitive.
Oh, you didn't really expect.
There are cases where you do get a fairly robust prediction. An example is with these early time stars where the Zond dynamical tide applies, and you have there's a quite a simple prediction for the frequency dependence of Q, and that seems to work as well.
There's a recent book, a Japanese author, where they look at the modern experiments in evaluating Q in laboratory various substances, and their conclusion is that Q is proportional to a positive power, fractional power of frequency. Positive fractional theory. And I rejected a paper written by a Ferenczi once, many years ago, because that leads to a singularity issue at zero frequency. Because, you have this frequency going to zero in the denominator as far as Q is concerned, and he's since written a paper with Jim Williams, which came out a couple of years ago, maybe this year, where apparently my objections have been answered, but I don't know, I haven't read it yet, so I don't know whether they really have or not. But anyway, Jim Williams rejected the paper originally as well. But now since he's a co-author, he must have been convinced, or he contributed to it to make it okay with his positive dependence. But in spite of all that, I think, the frequencies don't really go down the type of frequencies in the laboratory. So one could suppose that you would have, as you get near a zero frequency of a particular type of term, my assumption is that the Q at that point will be inverse of proportional frequency, so you get smooth transitions with the zero frequency. That's near a resonance. But you can't use the same Q for every resonance. You can't use this document be, it's only appropriate for that narrow region. You go to another residence, you may have the same cue, but you use a cue inverse with proportional frequency, all of those things, you get much different cues for this residence than you get to that residence. But that's probably related to the fact that Q is not strictly in proportional frequency. Well, the range is probably a complicated function of frequency.
So, Gordon, can we find written down somewhere Q values for the radiative stars you're referring to?
Well, it's not expressed in that language. So if you read Zahn's paper as...
It's
expressed in slightly different terms, but it's basically giving you its equivalent to saying that Q value is this function of frequency.
Yeah.
Well, it's a function of it's not a simple number.
No, it involves this 8/3 power, which is typical of this wave launching process.
This theory is well established. Zahn, Goldberg, Nicholson. Those things are not in the drawing source. The basic idea is correct, Goldberg, but quantitative name. Do you have a concern?
The Coriolis force will change things if you're. It changes the gravity waves themselves, but also, as we discussed earlier, you may, if you're in the range in which inertial waves can exist in the convective region, then that also contributes to the generation of new gravity waves.
So quantitative is not clear. Also, another key assumption is that the gravity wave propagating outward will be completely damped, nothing coming back. The other function is okay, I guess. Is that okay?
I haven't checked.
Yeah, nobody checked the part. Nobody. The key assumption just say wave coming in and propagating outwards and just complete that. You never have anything reflect back from the photosphere.
Well, I expect the waves are likely to damp through nonlinear, for example. If not through radiative.
Yeah, it's radiative.
Yeah.
I think that's key in Lubov's paper too.
The idea, I think, is not established, but quantitatively, I'm not sure.
You're right that in the Coriolis force does make a difference. Yeah. And if we're talking about synchronized binary stars, the circularization of synchronized binary stars is certainly strongly affected by Coriolis.
There is this issue of whether synchronization occurs before circularization. In radiative stars, it is generally assumed that you achieve synchronism before you achieve circular orbit. But I think one of the problems is that in many of the close binary systems, the orbits are circular, but their rotation are not synchronous.
Hartwigs at time scales, are they actually useful?
Sorry?
Hartwigs works out these different time scales, the different parameters.
And they couldn't just have been born circularly.
Yes.
And just not synchronous.
Well, there's always this argument that there's clear trend in stellar clusters that the short period systems are circular and long period systems have distributions all over the place, just like the planets. Mm-hmm. And this cutoff is called circularization period. And it's depends on the age of the system. You can go so that is clear evidence, but strong supporting evidence for. I want to be careful with your slippery. strong evidence in support of this argument that they didn't know with circular orbit. Otherwise, why should the very close system form with
circular orbit? It's the same with the exoplanets. When you get close, the orbits are much more circular, with some exceptions. You showed that.
But if you rely on the wave dissipation, say, in the atmosphere, radiative dissipation, don't you always have to worry about the possibility that what you see at the surface is not what you get in the bulk of the star? I mean, that's always an issue, right? Because it's a very localized, so it's going to generate different
transition. So wherever you dissipate, you also dump angular momentum.
That's right. So you
these two things go hand.
That's right. So you have to solve the differential rotation problem.
It's a big galaxy.
I'm interested in a system that has a circular orbit.
I think if you go back to the papers in, maybe, was it in Papaloizzo and Savanay, or there's also some paper by Peter may be involved in this. And I remember going back and reading on this. That was in the 70s, or I think there was, in fact, Zahn had some, this is where the debate came in. Between Zahn and Papaloizzo and Savanay, and they had a big argument, and then there was a paper, it may have been the Gorak and Kili paper that started.
But in the stars, you have differential rotation.
That was not addressed. Original.
Could you cite its systems that they have observed? That means they have a
massive stars.
Line width, I assume, which implies rotation. And then they can measure the period of the.
I think they can. Certainly there's line weights, but there's also, I think just from the light curve, they can actually measure just almost like the Rosenberg-McLaughlin effect, which was originally introduced to binary stars initially, as in any case, right? So they have a good measurement of that. And if I remember correctly, then you know, and it may have been in the introduction of the paper by Gorak and Keeley,
I wonder if that refers back. You know, non-synchronous rotation is just a matter of measuring the atmospheric rotation instead of the whole rotation.
Gorak Nicholson. So, yeah.
Morris Nicholson was Jupiter, of course.
But there was also, I think there was another paper.
Radio.
Yeah, they had another paper. And that discussed, they were trying to settle a dispute between Savanay and Papaloizzo and Zahn. And that's in that context, whether it was synchronization or circularization, I think. I can't remember.
The circularization was the original estimate of Q for stars, right?
Yeah, that's where you can come up with that. And it turns out for the Young Titori, well, not Young Titori, but if you go to, let's say, in the Pleiades,
yeah,
and the Q you would determine is much smaller than you would determine, well, it's about 10 to the 5. And if you go to a later stages, that is go to 10 to the 6 or even 10 to the 7. But there is some uncertainty because this circularization period is not clear cut.
How many binary stars are in the
Pleiades? I don't know the answer to that, but at the right period and also you're trying to do it with the solar type stars. Okay, you're making lots of comparisons. So then the number really gets down. And
they have enough
statistics. The best person you can trace there is Bob Matthews. And I think he wrote maybe a annual review article.
Yeah.
And describing a lot of these things. But there is some, clearly statistics bothers him. Even until maybe 2 or 3 years ago, maybe there wasn't there a paper a few years ago?
Yeah, there are some recent updates which give a less clear picture, I would say,
than before.
The earlier observations suggested a Q of 10 to the 6, but I think the newer interpretation, which is based on not just trying to identify a single transition between circular and eccentric orbits, but trying to fit the entire distribution, actually gives a more confused picture.
What kind of star is this you're talking about?
Solar.
Well, so-called solar-type binaries, but in fact, that means that the primary star lies in a certain range, right, and the secondary could be anything.
This is important to be concerned what the companion is, because if it's a binary star, the companion is quite massive. So there are two things that's important. One is the transfer of tidal angular momentum rate. It's large. The other is the amplitude, as Gordon mentioned this morning. So you have large amplitude, then when you have these waves that propagates to the center of the star, it can, you know, overturn and dissipate and not return. That's one issue. And if you have a low mass planet, maybe this won't work. And the second issue is that if you have a companion, because all stars lose angular momentum through stellar wind, but if you have a companion, close companion, you can get the angular momentum back from the orbit of the binary companion. So therefore you can maintain rapid rotation. The rotation frequency of the star can be comparable to the main motion. Whereas if you have a planet on the side and the star can de-spin and they become slow rotators. In fact, these guys observe, they preferentially choose slow rotators. And so when you have slow rotation, then the Coriolis effect that Gordon talks about this morning, that is much more weakened. Mm-hmm. And then you don't get into this inertial range. Mm-hmm. And then in that case, and maybe also the Q, the effective Q you will get will be very different. So just because a binary star gives you that Q, it doesn't mean that in the case of a planet, you will get the same.
The total rainbow of one state.
It's clear that Q is beguiling beyond its validity. Any other comments?
What would be, at some point, just a question for the two talks of today, what would be good observations that could help make some progress? In terms of what kind of parameter or precision, or are there special systems that could be of great use? Because it's all very theoretical, and I understand that it's complex, that there are many different phenomena, but it looks to me at light years from my observational progression.
Only 10 light years. You can go travel there and measure, go into the star.
For example, knowing the age of the star or the system, will that help?
Yeah, that's certainly an important parameter. And if it were possible to decide with some of these short period planets whether they really have circular orbits or not, yeah, to detect unambiguously a non-zero eccentricity in a short period of time, that would be very interesting. Mm-hmm.
And that's the case for transiting planets if you have the secondary tips, that helps a lot.
So that's happening.
In WASP-18b, it looks like the best case now, I think.
Yeah, so many of these new cases are very interesting for tidal theory. The possibility of measuring A dot or N dot is also very interesting.
Very lost between BS is at last, we have a major Q on the star. But now I'm not so sure. If a Q is large, all we have is a lower bound.
Well, it's still a very interesting constraint.
Yeah.
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 That was my point this morning, but it may not get enough. I hope you do.
But I guess, well, the constraints have to be interpreted in some probabilistic way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we have people here at SCO that are watching that system, so we'll know right away what the transit times are changing.
Less expensive
than
Q. Yep. Thank you, Rosemary.
Yes, thank you.